8. April 1848. Commander Gore has been gone, presumed dead, for 8 months. It is about to begin. He never sees any of it. He imagines it instead. He reads books about it, published decades, centuries after it happens. He takes the awful images conjured by scholars and hobbyists and palms out a story. The companies of Erebus and Terra struggle through the winter of 1847. Their best sportsman is dead. Not that there's much hunting to be had. A single storm on the ice wipes out another hunting party of 2 officers and 3 men, whose bodies are never found. Others succumb to the claws of the climate, to scurvy, to madness. Men starve and rave, dreaming of gravy. There isn't enough coal to heat the ships, nor enough candles to light the Arctic winter. Franklin's bold adventurers lie for hours in the dark, too cold and hungry to move, while the darkness looks like ink-soaked cardboard pressed against the portholes. The ships smell like carrion. Spring comes. By this time, 9 officers and 15 men are dead. The highest death rate of a polar expedition in hundreds of years. Crozier, whose soul barely inhabits his flaking, creasing body, orders the ships abandoned. Franklin's expedition, still in 1848, Franklin's expedition, and not Franklin's lost expedition, will march 800 miles with provisions to last barely half that, and hope that on the journey south, they'll find game and open water. They fasten whale boats onto runners and fill them with what they imagine they will need. Tents, of course, their sleeping bags of seal skin and deer pelt, their provisions, which are mostly tinned. 1 set of spare underclothes per man. Guns for hunting. Other things, too. They pile the whale boats with soap and books and candlesticks and journals and crockery. They are afraid they might be needed. They are afraid of everything, so they leave nothing. Their backs bruise under the weight of the boats. Their joints crack. They die by inches. They haul the boats. The officers pull alongside the men. Even Crozier and Fitzjames haul. The men are too weak to manage alone. There is no beauty in this, not after the first 50 miles. Just sore bodies, frostbite, and dysentery. The surviving surgeons are granted a marine guard each to keep desperate sailors out of the medicine chests. The marines have orders to shoot on sight. Goodsir is, for a time, one of the surviving surgeons, but he's seen off by a tooth infection and dies with poisoned blood. He is lucky. He is buried. They haul the boats. They start by burying the dead in shallow graves, then, further on, piling rocks over the bodies in makeshift cairns. But soon, there are too many dead. They leave the bodies where they drop. They haul. They abandon empty cans, trinkets, clothing. They leave bizarre oases of clutter, civilization in its larval form. The notion of expedition of England streams off them. They put 1 foot in front of the other and balance their minds on their heads. They haul. The landscape looks like something suspended in glass. It is like walking through a perfect, terrible illusion. Their tiredness is an omnipresent thing, god of the bones and the sinew. Gore reads that 30 or so survivors from the 100-odd crew make it to a final camp. Starvation Cove, later explorers call it. They are still hundreds of miles from the nearest European outpost. Gore dreams about his friends. He sees Le Viscount lying on the canvas of a collapsed tent. Henry, he says in the dream, Le Visconte does not respond. He has no legs, and half his pelvis is missing. His hip bone pokes through torn meat like the gunwales of a shipwreck. The bone is not white, but ivory and speckled grey. Le Visconte's mouth is slack and open. The dark purple fruit of his tongue lolls from his lips. His eyes are white and slimy. They have rolled back in his head. Gore dreams he sees Lieutenant Little of Terror creeping towards the body. Blood is tracking sluggishly down Little's face. His eyes are clouded. Gore understands, in the dream, that Little can no longer see people, only flesh. "Edward, listen to me," Gore says. Little creeps along the stones. "Edward, that was a man, not food." Surviving testimony suggests the Inuit tried to help where they could. But more than 100 poorly prepared Europeans, already dying in a land where the Inuit lived at a level of strict subsistence, in a year where summer never came, were too many souls to save. Franklin's expedition hadn't been invited to the Arctic. Why did they insist on leaving their bodies so far from their native earth? This is the rational response. Gore knows better. He thinks of the face of the woman whose husband he killed. He wakes up with the taste of dead flesh in his mouth. It is God's love, or God's vengeance, that he survived in this impossible way, that he has to remember them all, and her besides. He will not be responsible for another death, another friend lost. He dreams with the bitter determination of a man who must reach camp before dark.
Chapter 8. The days flickered between catastrophic rain and unseasonal heat, flashing dark and bright as starkly as a chessboard. We played at domesticity, rearranging our strange new home around the belongings the ministry had thought to seize from our old one. The ministry, meanwhile, locked down. The administrative team began the unwieldy, bug-polluted process of moving data and confidential information onto another secure server. Internal comms were a mess. Emails bounced or sent with hysterical duplicates. The phones blue-screened. Even our keycards stopped functioning properly. Somalia got herself trapped in a mystery vestibule because her keycard caused the lock to melt when she touched it to the pad, showering her with a terrifying rain of fat green sparks and setting off the alarms. I was in the building at the time, on my way to a meeting with Adela. The alarm was curiously nasal, like a complaint just at the edge of articulation. Someone from the ops and maintenance department staggered full pelt past me, and I followed in their wake. When we got to the fused door, I could hear Somelia loudly reciting the hollow crown speech from Richard II on the other side, bashing rhythmically on the door with the iambs. "We can hear you," I called. "We're getting you out."
"We are we?"
muttered the maintenance woman. Back office ops loathed the bridges. I'd never understood why, but I was paid too much to care. Somelia, once she emerged, was back in her uniform of chic, though she'd lost some weight and moved sepulchrally inside her deconstructed blazer. She'd also let her hair out into an afro, which I'd never seen her do before. It suited her, though I wasn't sure whether I was allowed to say this, and so I didn't.
"You,"
she said. "Me. Hello."
"And baby makes three,"
said the maintenance woman. She snorted when we ignored her and cantered off. The ministry suffered a maintenance emergency more or less every half hour during the lockdown. She'd be needed elsewhere. "Technically, Ivan made three," I said. "But you know he's in the process of being stood down."
"What?"
"Adela thinks Cardingham's development is better left in the hands of the field agent program. We can make a soldier out of him, but probably never a modern metrosexual."
"And I heard Ralph is under house arrest,"
said Somalia. "Protective custody," I corrected. He's ex-defense, likely high on any anti-ministry hit list.
Do you know where his safe house is?
I shrugged. I knew where everyone's safe houses were. Adela had made it known to me that Graham and I were considered, by the ministry's bellicose hierarchy, the senior bridge expat team. We deserved more access, required more access, as Graham's adjustment was so pivotal and promising. If it was unfair, it was also useful. Certainly Adela's insistence that we were special in some way tallied with my experience of being in love. My keycard had stopped working on ministry property, and Adela has cancelled our last three meetings, said Somalia. I've been trying to get Arthur's benzodiazepine prescription re-evaluated, and his own wellness team is blocking me. Do you know why this is all happening? All we've been told is emergency procedures.
Someone tried to kill me, I said. The Brigadier.
Watching what happened on Somelia's face was like watching a paper cut fill with blood. I saw the shock of impact, the brief beat of perhaps nothing, the welling. She reached for me and, I think, would have embraced me, but her hand brushed the gun beneath my jacket. She pulled back. I can speak to Adela about Arthur, if you like, I said, holding her gaze. I'm going to see her now.
Thank you, said Somalia, very coldly. That would be kind.
Look after yourself. One pleasant spring afternoon, I arranged to go with Arthur, Margaret, and Graham to a Turner exhibition. The expats played a game that they called ghost hunting. They would visit a place, a pub, a monument, a stately home, or a gallery or exhibition, to see if they could spot anything or anyone that they recognized from their own era. In this instance, they expected Graham would see the most ghosts, as the exhibition was devoted to Turner's marine paintings. In fact, I'd organized the jolly little trip, haunted by plainclothes agents and signed off by Adela, partly because I wanted to test the limits of my special status, but also because I felt responsible for them. After the move to the safe houses, it became abundantly clear that Arthur and Margaret were not enjoying the same meaningful cultural integration as Graham, or even as Cardingham, by which I mean the ministry simply found them less interesting. Fewer and fewer meetings were devoted to their adjustment, their long-term goals. Only the readability experiments continued to run with any degree of consistency. Besides that, I knew Graham, who kept up a supervised and frequently curtailed program of visits, had told them something about what was happening behind our doors, in our beds. I didn't know what. Graham was vague and evasive when I asked him, but he must have found a word for lovers that didn't make him feel excessively Victorian and ashamed. And now I had no control whatsoever over how Margaret and Arthur might be receiving this knowledge about me. I had to fix it. Margaret, who understood how to sneak soft drink cans and snacks into cinemas, was not impressed by the idea of the gallery trip. Consider how much she'd had to learn, negotiating supermarkets, brands and flavors, the invention of the aluminium can, the basic untrustworthiness of the popcorn counter, the invention of film.
"We're hence to look at pictures of boats?" she asked, exasperated, in the car.
"Ships. 65. Ships," said Graham. "The finest of the line."
"Big boats," Arthur supplied.
Graham's shoulders stiffened. The exhibition was divided into several rooms, which charted Turner's developing practice throughout his life. I stared listlessly at detailed and virtuosic paintings of big boats at sea, tilting horribly in the wind. "Were you ever seasick?" I asked Graham.
"Not since I was a boy. A gorse stomach is a nigh unturnable one."
"Feel sick just looking at these."
"You could not be a ship's cat, poor little cat."
It wasn't until I walked later into Turner's century, the 1830s, the 1840s, that I started to see what all the fuss was about. The forensic detail of the early paintings was gone. In their place, the sensory drama of the rain, the wind, and the waves was portrayed in sweeping, fuzzy strokes, more suggestion than depiction. I stood and gawped stupidly in front of the fighting Temeraire, irradiated by its impossible orange sun. I felt a gentle hand on my jaw. Arthur was closing my mouth.
"You'll catch flies," he said.
"It's very impressive, isn't it?"
"Very. Even Maggie has stopped complaining. 47 is transfixed. Over there."
I glanced over. Graham was staring hard at a canvas I'd recently pulled away from. The slave ship. "Ah, right. Let's leave him to it."
"He's told me a little about his time sailing with the preventative squadron. Is that the correct terminology? Sailing with?"
Arthur added, embarrassed by the affection he'd loaded his voice with. "Beats me. Floating around with is about my level of expertise. Here, let's sit down." Margaret was already sitting on the padded benches in the middle of the room. She gave us a wave.
"I caused the sounding of the bell," she said.
"You set an alarm off."
"Yes."
"Well done," said Arthur. "How long did it take?"
"I felt my hearness readily. The guard was most vexed. In faith, I would not steal these pictures. I'm not so fond of boats."
"Big boats," I said.
Arthur laughed and settled between us. I was shy of Arthur. Most friendship quartets don't function in squares but in lines, and Arthur and I were the furthest away from one another. I liked him, and in any other circumstances, it would have been impossible not to adore someone with as good a heart as he had. But he was in love with Graham. It was all over him like chickenpox. I felt myself going harridan and crooked when Graham looked longer than usual at Margaret, so I couldn't imagine what it cost Arthur to be around me. Still, he was the most forgiving soul I ever met. I suspected he blamed himself, his gender, his era, his heart.
"Have you come to a decision on your film schools, 65?
He was asking.
"Prague," said Margaret promptly. "It is not so far. You may visit me."
Margaret's primary skills were of the household running variety, chores she had barely engaged with since arriving in the future, and which she had no intention of picking up again. She had her letters, as she put it, but she was still attending adult literacy classes. She'd fixated on the notion of film schools, that she lived in a world where she could be trained to create cinema, her favorite thing in the 21st century. The ministry did have a budget for retraining the expats, but there was no way they would let Margaret out of London, let alone Britain. Perhaps Ralph had been wringing out some daydreams for her.
"Where will you be apprenticed, 16?
Asked Margaret. "Do you have any sense of what in this brave new world you'd like to do?" I asked.
"Have a rest,"
said Arthur.
"Yeah, wouldn't we all? You could try something scandalously outre instead. Joining the circus, professional go-go dancing, accountancy."
Arthur smiled. He was twisting the signet ring on his finger. Margaret reached out and took his fidgeting hand.
"Speak it," she said.
Arthur sighed. Then he said,
"I think the suffragettes did bally well. I can see that our famous career opportunities for a bright and ambitious young lady, but I can't help noticing that the exchange has not been all equal. I rarely see chaps taking care of old folks or scrubbing the floors. People still look at a man ferrying a child without a wife alongside with something like suspicion or pity."
"You want to work with children?" I said, alarmed. We didn't have material on how to deal with the expats if they got broody, and I wasn't much good at it with normal people either. Arthur gave me a despairing look.
"You see? You're surprised. Maybe disappointed."
"No, that's not what..."
"Arthur, of course that's possible." "Is it? I've read all sorts on the liberation of the queers. Do you say it like that? The queers? Anyway... And the working women and the feminist revolution and so on and so forth. But, you know, I'm not 47. I stay awake through everything I watch, and I can see what your era likes. Use the same patterns as we did, as Gray's people did, and Maggie's too. You just expect women to do more of it, that's all.
But you're not a woman, Arthur, I said. He threw me an amused look, not in one-upmanship, but playfully for me to catch, and said,
But I'm not the blueprint for the perfect man, either.
You are the print of a perfect egg, said Margaret.
Thank you, 65.
I love you very well, Egg.
Love you too. That's a fine example of what I mean, by the way. I am supposed to hatch into something very useful and effective to make all of this palaver with bringing me over here worth its salt. Even back home, excuse me, back in my era, there was always a sense that money and effort had gone into mixing my preparation, and I'd jolly well better bake and set in the right mold and not go off my onion in any way. The reward is, well, all the finer things. Children, family, some peace of mind. But the cost is matching the recipe. And I am a little off my onion, you know.
So you want children? I asked, audibly floundering. Arthur tossed me another look, but this one was opaque. I'd feel terrible shame about that, in the weeks and months and years afterwards. I couldn't find the right words to answer him, couldn't even imagine, high-achieving poster child of an immigrant preserved by the benevolent British state that I was, what the answer might be. But I was saved by Graham's arrival at the bench. Arthur turned his face up to him.
Hello, Graham. Have you finished looking at the big boats?
Ships. I am done with this room, yes.
Did you see any nice boats? Asked Arthur pleasantly.
Ships, Graham said, and stalked off.
We got up and adjusted our clothes. We were all wearing sheepish, excitable expressions, like children caught drawing on walls. We followed Graham into the next room and crowded around him, clucking annoyingly.
This sail has the aspect of a cloud. It is wondrous fair. Did you ever mistake an enemy sail for mere weather, 47?
I like this guy's cool little bandana.
Did you ever wear a cool little bandana?
Something groovy.
This one is rather good, with a burst of light, as if the big boat is coming to collect passengers to heaven. God's own dear little ferry.
You are all tedious people, he said calmly. I should have you flogged for insubordination.
Did you ever order floggings? I asked. He ignored me to read the painting's legend. Quite suddenly, he straightened up, eyes blank, and moved off without speaking.
Oh, said Arthur, distressed. Do you think we went too far?
I read the legend. Hurrah for the whaler Erebus, another fish, 1846. Turner seems to have borrowed the name of this whaling ship from HMS Erebus, which with her companion vessel, the Terror, had sailed for the Arctic the previous year. In one of the greatest disasters in polar exploration, neither ship nor any of their company returned.
Ah,
I said. He brushed off all attempts to comfort or question him, of course. He arranged the conversation so that his momentary lapse of face was obscured. It was a trick of his, as expertly wielded as his perfect cogency with his here-ness and there-ness. He would build sentences around the rooms where burnt and broken things squatted, and I would never be able to see the damage for the bars. Cars took us back to our separate safe houses. Margaret and Arthur wilted as they retreated into the vehicles. Their days of free wandering were over. The 21st century was a thing that was happening outside their windows. Of course I felt sorry for them. They'd been at the mercy of the ministry since they arrived. Every in-breath and shed tear was monitored. But the ministry had saved their lives.
It had some small say in how those lives continued. At home, Graham, his jaw set and his eyes dull, pushed me against the door.
Do you remember, I said, that this is more or less how we first kissed?
Don't ask me about the things that I remember,
he muttered. I put my hands through his hair and he put his face in my neck.
Please,
he murmured. When he was inside me and his breath was dewing my throat, I wondered what was going through his mind. I kissed him until my lips hurt and I tried to hear his thoughts. What was it like to be the only one who came back? The only one who still had a body to touch, to hurt, to yearn with? The last one still able to die?
The crumble and leak of our new lodgings were as uncomfortable as wearing ill-fitted clothing. I became acutely aware of the vulnerability of my body, as if it were a rented house with locks I hadn't had the chance to change. The field agent program included a course in unarmed combat, and I signed up to see if it would make me feel any better. After I'd attended 6 sessions, Adela appeared one day, in expensive athleisure.
Spar with me, she said. I'd like to see what you've learned.
Mainly that it's almost always better to run away.
That's a start,
said Adela, then kicked my feet out from under me. I hit the mat with an embarrassing grunt woof.
You didn't say we'd started.
Attackers generally don't,
said Adela placidly. I rolled out of the way just before her heel came down on my stomach and scrambled upright.
No, if it's the Brigadier, he'll just shoot me with... He's got this weapon that makes blue light and...
You've escaped once. There. Why do you strike so slowly? Now I have your wrist.
I wrenched free and skittered backwards.
What does that mean, I've escaped once? I panted. Is he coming back? Do you have information on that? Where is he? Ow! Jesus!
I was merely remarking upon it. You are more capable than you realize. How is Commander Gore?
Adela asked, easily blocking 2 weak punches.
I understand the quartermaster's filed permission to train him on long-range weapons. You are telegraphing your punches.
I don't want to hurt you.
You're not going to, she said, and landed a meaty blow into my shoulder.
Ow!
Block.
Ow! I'm trying. Yeah, he's at the ministry almost as much as I am. Not just for training either. For historical context too, I think. Ah! Like, no one explains the Cold War better than the archivists. Fuck! Ow! Also, a while ago, I dropped some big history on him with no context, and he's working his way backwards through declassified missions.
Blitzkrieg in 9/11.
Ouch! The trenches in Auschwitz, actually.
Adela froze, the edge of her hand arrested mid-strike.
What?
I said the word Auschwitz out of context, and he spent all night looking up the Holocaust.
You didn't tell him about the attack on the Twin Towers?
Asked Adela. She seemed genuinely confused. Her hand hovered in midair. I hesitated, then decided this must mean the sparring was over, and relaxed.
No. God, can you imagine? He'd already spent 1839 blowing up the Sultanate at Aden. I'm not sure how much I'd trust him to keep the whole war on terror thing in, like... non-racist proportion.
Yes,
said Adela in a flaking voice.
If he'd come to the news abruptly, he would have converted to the ministry on the spot.
She met my eye and added,
I imagine.
Slowly, the look went rancid.
I had my guard down. It would have been sensible to attack then,
she said, and punched me in the face. Beating the shit out of me put Adela in a good mood for several days. I wrangled permission from her to take Graham for a monitored bike ride to Greenwich to see the Franklin Expedition Memorial. We can't expect him to adjust without closure, I'd said, and it might improve his grip on his here-ness and there-ness. I know he's already scoring highly on voluntary readability, but there's no harm in reinforcing it.
She looked at me as you might a cat, who, with unusual perspicacity, has brought home a £10 note instead of a dead mouse. The day I'd chosen was, in fact, fair. The light was even and soft, like carefully sifted flour. Deranged by the heat shift, unseasonal roses were bursting and shedding luminously in front gardens and public squares. A cool breeze ran alongside us as we cycled. It resembled nothing so much as a handshake. As with every time I experienced clement weather, I was overcome with the sense that my troubles and pains had been put on hold, and would resume after an interval break in which I could, spiritually speaking, use the bathroom and get a drink and generally fix myself. Under the March sunlight, the buildings of the old Royal Naval College looked scrubbed and canvas clean. He stared out over the long green lawns, frowning.
It's a monument to itself.
Yes, but a very beautiful one.
How curious that I have survived to watch my obsolescence grow old enough to be celebrated as legendary.
He walked slowly up the path, looking around as if he'd never seen a building in the world before.
Little cat,
he said, and I obediently trotted to his side. There were at least two other people in sight distance, which meant we were in public, which meant he wasn't going to kiss me or embrace me. But he reached out and quickly squeezed my hand. For him, this was a scandalous display of affection. We walked side by side to the chapel, at a chaste and proper distance, and up the steps.
Oh,
he said.
Somehow I did not think it would be right there.
The chapel's memorial to the Franklin expedition, under which the body tenuously identified as Assistant Surgeon Harry Goodsir was buried, was in an alcove near the entrance. I was embarrassed by the sight of a half-rolled poster display for a recently closed exhibition and a small herd of black queue barriers which had been left nearby. The moment should have been grand, heartrending, important. I felt sure there should be mournful organ music. Instead, the memorial looked forgotten. He stood and stared for a long time at the engraved muster roll of officers.
They promoted Edward, then,
he said softly.
Good.
Well, the mates got their commission too.
Oh, as it ever was. One often had to wait for someone to die in order to ascend the ranks. It's just unusual for the person dying to be oneself.
I smiled unsurely. He was very pale. The trick of the shadow had swallowed the green in his eyes. They were an opaque, flat brown, like a spring tree that had failed to regrow.
And Dr. Goodsir is...
Yes.
He was in fine, bombastic form the last time I saw him. He came out to the Magnetic Observatory and went into rhapsodies about the lichen. He told me moss is a sign that God has a sense of humour, and fungi that he has a sense of awe. He was very eccentric. You would have liked him.
Yeah, I've read his letters home. He seemed like a funny man.
I forget that we are objects of study to you, that you can read our private correspondence.
Sorry.
No, don't be. At least they are remembered and cared for still.
I didn't know how to respond to this. I touched my fingers to his palm. He made a soft gear-adjusting noise in his throat and said,
"Would you mind if I had some time alone here?"
"Of course not. Should I wait?"
"You may wish to find something to occupy yourself."
"Ah, yes. I'll go to the museum." I regretted saying that, because part of the museum had relics dug up from the collapse of his expedition, but he was already in a different place in his mind. He didn't look at me, but he reached out and brushed my cheek, as he might have absentmindedly petted an animal.
"Thank you," he said.
In the end, it was an hour before he sent me a carefully composed text, arranging to meet me near the entrance of the Greenwich Foot Tunnel. We got lunch at a food stall, and I could see him trying to work out the recipe for the Nutella-covered pisangareng. I joked that we'd have to buy a fire blanket, and he accused me of having little faith, then asked why I'd never let him have Nutella before. I said that I tried not to let myself have it, otherwise I ceased to partake of the other food groups. He said,
on the subject of which?
Yes?
Cannibalism. I knew those men.
Yes.
And they wouldn't have done that.
He looked at me, as if debating how much I would weigh if I were hundreds of beans and poured in a bottle.
Would they?
He added. I'm sorry. If you know about that, then you know how we know. The Inuit had no reason to lie. And, well, we found the remains, eventually. The British, I mean, and the Canadians, and so on. The bones had knife marks. There's this thing called pot polishing. He held up his wooden fork and I broke off. His lips were pale, so was the rest of his face. But it was the lips that startled me. Finally, he said,
do you believe the natives were telling the truth?
Graham, it's what happened. There's archaeological evidence.
But then you believe that it could have been true of me.
It would have been true of anyone. They were starving.
And the Eskimo didn't help.
We say Inuit. They crossed paths here and there. I know there's at least one record of a successful joint caribou hunt after the ships were abandoned. But, I mean, you must remember what King William Island looked like. There's just not enough game to support that many men. He gave me a strange, blurry look, like he was burying something in the back of his skull.
Do you know the names of the last men?
He asked. No. About 30 men made it to the final camp at Starvation Cove. But we don't know who. Some people think the very last survivors were Captain Crozier and Dr. MacDonald, based on Inuit testimony. But really, we have no idea. Relief crept through his face. I wondered who he had imagined, starving and blank-eyed, picking calf muscle from their teeth. The next morning, when I woke up, he was in my bed. We'd taken to sleeping together most nights. He slept as if a plug had been pulled on his brain. He looked sweetly boyish when he was asleep, and it made me afraid. I adored him, and it was robbing me of a layer of skin. But he was rarely still in bed in the mornings, as he rose some 2 hours before I did. When I saw him there, lying still on his back and staring at the ceiling, I felt a shiver of wrongness.
I'm never going back, am I?
He said. His voice was low and conversational, as if we were picking up a chat we'd been having 5 minutes beforehand. I wriggled closer and settled my hand on his chest. No, you can't.
I don't think I really believed it, but it's true. They're all dead. Everyone I ever knew is dead. Everything I had in my life is gone.
I rubbed my thumb on his chest. Be present and calm, the wellness team had advised.
Focus on action. Accept confusion. Do not demand explanation.
He stared at me, vague and empty, the way an animal looks at a book.
There is no one left in the world who has known me for longer than a few months. I am a stranger in a strange land.
I know you.
Do you?
I'm trying. I'd like to know you better. Something softened in his face, enough that I caught a glimpse of the ocean of sadness he had dammed and kept damming every night, every day.
Come here,
he said. People sometimes asked me if I'd ever been back to Cambodia. I told them I'd visited. On one such visit, with my parents and my sister, my mother arranged a trip to the seaside resort town of Kep. There, women manning market stalls cooked mudfish and baby squid over charcoal and cheerfully fleeced us. My mother's pen accent, as poor a passport as her family's western faces. And we ate fish and rice with prahok and bitter melon on a raised wooden picnic platform. A wandering drinks vendor with Sakyant tattoos told my mother that nice Khmer girls didn't drink, and my father had to buy the beers and sneak them to her, holding up a fan each time she took a sip, an operation they managed with increasing hilarity. When we were fed and had made a memory of it, she took us further up the coast. Eventually, we found what she was looking for in an abandoned, weed-choked plot smelling outrageously of animal behaviors. She pulled up something red from the floor.
Look.
It was part of an intricately carved floor tile, bearing the rubbed remains of a mandala pattern. We started to look, amazed, around our feet.
It was my family's holiday home, said my mother. Your grandmother chose the tiles.
When something changes you constitutionally, you say, the earth moved. But the earth stays the same. It's your relationship with the ground that shifts. The time travel project was the first time in history that any person had been brought out of their time and into their far future. In this sense, the predicament of the expats was unique. But the rhythms of loss and asylum, exodus and loneliness, roll like floods across human history. I'd seen it happen around my own life. I knew Graham felt adrift on treacherous waters. He desired me, that much was obvious now. But either he wished that he didn't, or he wished we could have done it his way. He was in an uncertain relationship with everything in our era, but he knew how to make love to me, and he knew it was what I wanted. If I'd let him have his choice, he would never have touched me, but would have courted me chastely in that little house until the ministry made him enough of a man that he could create an honest woman out of what he had to work with. I suppose I mean to say that I'd betrayed him, because he'd been told I was his anchor, and instead I insisted he become mine. Betrayed him in other ways too, of course, by keeping secrets from him and reporting on him. But that was all in the original job description. He sat with his back against the headboard and held me in his lap, rutting unhurriedly into me. My mouth and breasts stung pleasurably where he had kissed me and rasped me with the shadow of stubble on his chin. He rolled one of my nipples like a rosary bead between his knuckles and clasped my hips in one arm, pinning me in place.
Let me be good and take it slowly.
Twice I'd wrenched myself off him and tried to provoke him into rough movement with my mouth and my hands. Our bodies were slick with sweat, and when I moved away from him to do this, the cold air in the bedroom lapped at me with a peculiar frigid eroticism. When I came back to him, he licked my mouth clean.
Let me.
No,
he said, and bit me lightly on the throat. On my bedside table, my work phone started ringing.
Oh. Ignore it.
It's work.
So far as I understand it, I am your work. Thus, you are working. Do you like it? And I am very deep. Like this?
The phone rang out, a few seconds of silence. Then it started again.
For God's sake, I should...
He sighed, then lifted me up and dropped me onto my back. I hooked an ankle around his hips. Soon he didn't even need that urging. The bed thudded ferociously against the wall. I came, one foot scrabbling at his calf, to the sound of the headboard thumping and the phone ringing. It was very stressful. He climaxed soon after, gasping in my ear. I stroked his back, touching the bump of the microchip. All the tension streamed off him and he flopped onto me.
Heavy? I think I put my back out trying to hold your hips at the right angle,
he said peacefully.
For which you are welcome, by the way.
Get off! Phone!
I'll stay here until I can feel my spine again.
I waggled about, trying to dislodge him.
You're going to get it all over your thighs,
he observed.
And then you'll be so annoyed.
What happened to the blushing virgin I married?
Well, we did not marry. You took me out of wedlock. Now I'm ruined.
This worked, however. He rolled off me and pulled the bedsheets around his hips. You weren't a virgin either, I said cheerfully. He ignored me. The phone lit up with a text message. It was from Adela.
Come to the ministry immediately.
9. May 1859. Captain Leopold McClintock's search expedition has spent 8 months locked in the ice by Bellot Strait. Frostbite, scurvy, and the long Arctic winter have ravaged his crew. Now, the sun is back, and sledging is once again practicable. McClintock's lieutenant, Hobson, heads south along King William Land. Some Eskimo have told him that 9 years before, they saw a straggling group of 30 starving, ragged white men, the purported remnants of Sir John Franklin's expedition to discover the Northwest Passage. Franklin's 2 ships, Erebus and Terror, have not been seen since July 1845. None of the officers and sailors who sailed with him have been found. The Eskimo hinted at other things, too. Dismembered bodies at makeshift campsites, boots boiled in pots, boots still filled with human flesh, knife scores on tibia, finger bones sucked clean of marrow, a last camp in a harbor on the mainland, where they found a corpse who had passed watch chains through gashes in his earlobes, perhaps for safekeeping, perhaps clinging to the idea that he might yet return to a place where the watch was worth something. Hobson spoons his rations and wonders what his own biceps would taste like. At the place the Europeans call Cape Felix, he finds the remains of a camp. There are tents still pitched, filled with bearskins and canvas sleeping bags. He finds 2 sextants, wire cartridges, snow goggles, brass screws. He concludes that this was not a camp of last resort, but a scientific observatory set up for the milder summer months. The only strange thing about it is the speed with which it was abandoned, leaving behind valuable property of the Royal Navy. Sledging further south, he discovers a cairn of piled stones. Inside is the only piece of communication from the Franklin expedition that will ever be discovered. A note on Admiralty notepaper, written over twice. The first message, in strong, confident handwriting, reads, HMS ships Erebus and Terror wintered in the ice in latitude 70 degrees 5 minutes north, longitude 98 degrees 23 minutes west. Having wintered in 1846-7 at Beachy Island, in latitude 74 degrees 43 minutes 28 seconds north, longitude 91 degrees 39 minutes 15 seconds west, after having ascended Wellington Channel to latitude 77 degrees and returned by the west side of Cornwallis Island. Sir John Franklin commanding the expedition. All well. Party consisting of 2 officers and 6 men left the ships on Monday 24th May 1847. Signed, Graham Gore, Lieutenant. Signed, Charles Frederick DeVoe, Mate. The second, wavering in the margins. 25th April, 1848. HM ships Terror and Erebus were deserted on the 22nd April, 5 leagues north-northwest of this, having been beset since 12th September, 1846. The officers and crews, consisting of 105 souls, under the command of Captain F.R.M. Crozier, landed here in latitude 69 degrees, 37 minutes, 42 seconds north, longitude 98 degrees, 41 minutes west. This paper was found by Lieutenant Irving under the cairn supposed to have been built by Sir James Ross in 1831, 4 miles to the northward, where it had been deposited by the late Commander Gore in May, redacted, June, 1847. Sir James Ross's pillar has not, however, been found, and the paper has been transferred to this position, which is that in which Sir J. Ross's pillar was erected. Sir John Franklin died on the 11th June, 1847, and the total loss by deaths in the expedition has been to this date 9 officers and 15 men. Signed, James Fitzjames, Captain, HMS Erebus. Signed, F.R.M. Crozier, Captain and Senior Officer. And start on tomorrow, 26th, the Back's Fish River. The note revealed two important things. Firstly, that the expedition had abandoned their ships in April 1848, after two consecutive summers so cold that the sea had remained frozen. 24 men had already died, and the lauded Franklin was among their number. Francis Crozier and James Fitzjames, captains of Terror and Erebus respectively, had led the ship's companies in an overland march of 800 miles. None, as far as Hobson could tell, survived the effort. Secondly, that Lieutenant Graham Gore, who had been granted a field promotion to commander, was dead before the march began. History had swallowed him, closing over him as the sea does over a luckless sailor.